Welcome to the Payments Journal Podcast. I'm your host, Rima Katz. While chargebacks may not be the most glamorous part of payments, it's top of mind for many, for merchants, financial institutions, and consumers. Today's guests, Robert Painter, Sales Manager Accounts, Dominic Cerrone, Vice President of Acquire Solutions at Equifax, and our own Brian Riley, Director of Credit and Mercator Advisory Group, dive into the current state of chargebacks and first-party misuse. They also discuss the new Visa CE 3.0 initiative and how it could have a significant impact on chargeback management, and what this also means for acquirers. Dominic, I'd like to start the conversation around first-party misuse. Are there cardholders in the know about the rules?
Yes, there are, but not as many as folks are claiming. Of course, everybody speaks, especially in today's age of the internet with all sorts of message boards, Reddit, for example, and other places within the dark web and the open web as well. And folks sharing and talking about chargeback rules. And, you know, for years I've been training chargebacks. And every time I train somebody on, in particular, card not present fraud chargebacks, you always get the comment from one of your students saying, oh my gosh, it's so easy to win a chargeback. So they feel, you know, a lot of folks feel that there are a lot of cardholders that are indeed in the know. And that is why the numbers worldwide have grown, especially since post-pandemic. I tend to disagree with that using data that I've reviewed and talking to some of my other peers as well. You know, it just pretty much, you know, I have 27 years on the acquiring side, but a few years on the issuing side as well. And when you train issuing bank analysts, chargeback is the last tool in their toolbox. They want to resolve that dispute. Chargeback is the tool within the disputes toolbox. And, you know, you want to make sure you're processing the chargeback with the right reason code. Your Visa, MasterCard do have indices internally that they're able to monitor. And they want to make sure on the issuing side that they are indeed using the correct reason codes. However, you know, since the pandemic, just like everybody else, there's staffing issues. Also with the advent of just more easily accessible user experiences through mobile apps, it's much easier, number one, to initiate a chargeback. You know, back in the day, the original rules were you must physically write into the billing dispute address within 60 days on a credit card, 30 days within a debit card, and go ahead and write out the entire dispute. And what has happened is it's become just easier to initiate. Also, they just don't have the manpower on the issuing side. So what is going on is they're using the path of least resistance, the frictionless method, which is, unfortunately, with fraud chargebacks, is all they have to do is click on a checkbox that says this is unauthorized. My cardholder certifies that this is unauthorized, and it just goes straight out the door. When in reality, the cardholder most probably said, I know who this is. I canceled back in June, and they have since subsequently billed me for July, August, and September. So that is a canceled recurring. So on the Visa side, 13.2, and not a 10.4 at Visa, and I'm just using Visa as an example. But if to process a 13.2, you must log in the cancellation date. You must log in the merchant attempts to try to resolve the issue with the merchant, but at least it's the correct reason code and the merchant has the way to answer that if they can. However, again, all of that takes time, 3, 4, 5 minutes to collect even, and that adds up. So what is the easier reason code to process? 10.4, 4837, card not present, MasterCard. Just click that box that says this is unauthorized, and there it goes out the door. So what we're seeing is it's more because of ease of use on the issuing side to process it than it is. It takes more manpower to process a consumer dispute. I don't know if, Robert, you want to chime in at all or...
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Yeah, I'd echo a lot of what you said. I think two things that stood out to me that you brought up is data and kind of how we got to where we're at today. Like on that side, like think about coming out of post-pandemic environment. We had consumers that never bought online, never picked up a phone. Like, you know, I think of my grandmother who's sending checks, you know, via mail in a catalog still. Well, now she's picking up her phone, logging into an app, creating a profile and going through an e-commerce checkout platform. Well, the thing that I always think is interesting is when a consumer goes to file a dispute, they don't really know that it's an actual chargeback. You know, they think, hey, I'm questioning this transaction. And to your point, Dom, maybe it was a reoccurring subscription or something that didn't make it on time because there was a shipping delay and there was a huge ice storm in Texas that extended things. And consumers are going through the process of just questioning where these transactions are at and how can I get a resolution to this? And then the second part that I think is really big and we'll talk to, I think, quite a bit today is the data aspect. You know, issuing banks want to do what's right for their customer and merchants want to do what's right for their customer. But that's a huge gap gap. How can the issuing bank see exactly what the merchant sees, or at least have insight to the transaction? Here's really what's going on. I think that's both of those two, in my mind, especially after the past few years, really kind of combined into this first party misuse or, you know, friendly fraud. Like I think we talk about this quite a bit. And one of the benefits of being a service provider in this industry is we talk to all these different verticals. We talk to all these different scenarios. And first party misuse and friendly fraud is just this giant brush of a catch-all. And we don't really see, and I guess, you know, we don't really see folks talking on chat forums about how to commit friendly fraud as much as we see consumers, issuing banks, and merchants not really having the same data set to make those decisions.
Yes, that is big. The idea is, especially in the Visa world, you know, when you answer a fraud charge back, it deals with a pre-arbitration, not a re-presentment. And when you present a pre-arbitration, you try to present as much enriched data as possible. It's not trying to win on rules. It's trying to get the cardholder to address the compelling evidence and to say, hey, I recognize this, you know, and they back down and they don't fight it any further. So it's very important for all the parties to have as much enriched data as possible. And, you know, that's what we're here to talk about today.
You know, something that's really important here, too, is that, you know, chargebacks are not the most glamorous portion of payments. Let's be real, right? It's not kind of like we're pulling up new technology or we're changing a payment form, but it's one of the big drivers here. You know, if you're a merchant and they're not handled right, it's going to affect your pricing. If you're a financial institution, you're not handling it right, you have risk for having sleeper fraud and other aspects of fraud building and not really doing it. So that, you know, when I think about disputes, it's, you know, as I said, it's not the hottest, coolest topic, but it's one of those things that the devil's in the details and you really have to get it right.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think when I look at the merchants and partners that we work with today, the biggest change I've seen over the past few years is there's always that mechanism of trying to resolve disputes once the dispute occurs, but really transitioning that to the post-authorization but pre-chargeback route. Like where can we send transaction details via Order Insights? When can we send information and resolve via RDR or alert services? I think that's, and I don't know, Dom or Brian, what you're seeing or hearing, but it's, I think over the past 2 years, just the shift from, hey, you know, there's a great way to settle this and there's great tools and mechanisms to settle this post-chargeback, but also we need to start to develop that pre-chargeback strategy as well.
Well, from where I sit, what I see is a lot, you know, getting this resolved right. This used to be an adversarial relationship between merchants and financial institutions. And a lot of that's changed because the financial institution wants the transaction because they're going to make interchange and probably interest. And the merchant certainly wants a sale. So that's been one of the reasons, I think, behind Visa's enhancing their dispute process, you know, to kind of streamline it, get some auto adjudication to pull out volume and really allow you to have time to focus on the exception items that make a big difference.
Yeah, so that's actually a very good point, Brian, in that, you know, everybody forgets the dispute realm goes beyond fraud. You know, you have consumer disputes. You have some pretty expensive individual consumer disputes, and you want your resources to focus on things like that so that you can get it right, you know. And all the ones that are data-driven, such as fraud, you want to just get it all aligned as possible, you know, and just get it right. So that is a very important point.
The new Visa CE 3.0 initiative could have a significant impact on chargeback management. Can you speak to it?
Well, I'll start off with, you know, it always comes out to everybody on the acquiring side for many years for card not present fraud. Now, is there a silver bullet? And I don't like that word, but silver bullet, you know, are there rules? As I said just earlier, you know, are there, when you respond to a Visa 10.4 fraud card not present, again, you're sending in rich data on a pre-arbitration. I mean, you're just hoping the other side backs down. But unfortunately, from a rule standpoint, unless the issuer doesn't check that little checkbox off, by the way, that is a pro tip, that if your processor sees that the little checkbox that says the cardholder has reviewed the compelling evidence and persists that the transaction is unauthorized, if that is not checked off, you technically can win an arbitration. They're rare, but it does happen, and folks need to pay attention. But most of the time, it is checked off. So what advantage do we have, you know, when the chargeback happens? So, Robert, I'll pass it on to you because this goes into Order Insight as well, if you want to talk about that some.
Yeah, I'd love to. I think that is, you know, when I look at compelling evidence and the new updates that are coming with the 3.0 initiative, I always like to think of it from a merchant capacity, right? The first thing that we like to educate merchants and providers that we work with is let's look at the magnitude and the depth of this, right? So really understanding how compelling evidence is going to affect you as a merchant. Because again, the rule change is phenomenal. I think it is the biggest thing that we have seen in the payments ecosystem change over the past really like 5 years. However, like forever, when you are reviewing your current transactions, let's see, do we have historical transactions to the same cardholder? How many of these events will qualify for compelling evidence? Do you have the data attributes that are necessary? So you can really start to evaluate what it is going to take and what it's going to affect. Meaning what it's going to take is sending this transaction level detail back to verify while that cardholder is in the middle of a dispute. Like, that's big. You know, being able to leverage order insights today is powerful, but being able to leverage order insights with the backup of a card network is even bigger. So I think, you know, one thing that I always like to encourage merchants to do is review your current transactions and see, you know, do you have device ID? Is that consistent? Do you have SKU level data, IP information? Do you have historical transactions to that consumer, right? These are the things that merchants have been really advocating for over the past 5 years is what can we do? We are sending this data. And I think now to have a major card network like Visa stand by merchants is going to be powerful.
There's really been a shift in some transaction volumes that are worth note too. And you think that typically e-commerce was growing at about 6 to 7%, and then we have COVID, right? And all of a sudden we're in double digits there. Yes. So that number's kind of normalized, but it's still certainly the trajectory was up. You know, Robert, when you mentioned your grandmother, that made me laugh, but there's a reality. There's demographics there that are really growing. And, you know, certainly on the millennial side, the younger age cohorts, that's one thing, but the usage is really strong at the other end of the spectrum. And that's worth noting too on it. And also when you kind of boil it together with, you know, the future of payments as a whole, things will be more e-commerce. That doesn't mean we're going to throw away our payment cards, but things are shifting there. So having that insight data is really important to give a merchant a glimmer of what's going on.
Yes, and it's also, it's important that we do know the real reason for the disputes. You know, one of the problems in addition to first-party misuse that turns into fraud / friendly fraud is the term fraud. You know, we're talking Visa here, so specifically we're talking TC40, the fraud report that's behind it. You know, that gets counted against the acquirer, even if the chargeback is quote-unquote won in the end, the dispute is won. What's going to happen is this is going to shift. It's not going to necessarily significantly reduce the overall chargeback count, but it will accurately start reporting fraud chargebacks into what they truly should be, which are consumer disputes. You know, they're saying I didn't receive this, or I canceled this 3 months ago and they're still billing me. And it also helps with the proper chargeback management. You're able to see your reason codes. And this is personally why I do like Visa better in general with their 28 different reason codes, because a risk department can accurately analyze what the issue is with their merchant by seeing the individual reason code. It's a lot tougher with MasterCard because they pretty much drilled it down to four main categories. And like, for example, like a 4853, it's a consumer dispute. Well, what is it exactly? Is it defective? Is it not received? You have to help drill down better. So this helps Visa's case even better because of the fact that we're shifting. Yes, we're going to see less fraud and we may see additional consumer disputes, but at least the data is more accurate in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a really good point to bring up. I think even if you look at the definition of a 10.4, it's, you know, other fraud. Like, what does that really mean, right? And I think that's the challenge. It's, to Brian's point too, is chargebacks aren't the flashiest thing. But when you're trying to decode really what's happening, again, as a merchant, they want to do what's right for their customers. And it's really difficult if that giant bucket of 10.4 chargebacks isn't really accurate to, hey, this is really an other fraud case that we need to dig into. So I would agree. I think, you know, the addition of compelling evidence 3.0, starting to factor out and whittle down to really what's going on, is going to be powerful for merchants and providers.
What does this mean for acquirers?
Yeah, so I mean, what does this mean for acquirers? Obviously, again, not to repeat myself, but to be honest with you, it helps acquirers indeed just get a better, it helps shift away the actual fraud reporting and having it reporting direct to where it should be. Please remember with Order Insight, for example, if the Order Insight comes in and we're able indeed to provide the same user ID, same IP address, same MAC address, the fraud chargeback is blocked from coming in and the TC40 is prevented from being processed. So when I say help acquirers, they're one of the number one banes of their existence is worrying about their VAMP numbers, the Visa Acquire Merchant Program. So those numbers will stay down. But even if the chargeback does happen and they end up winning the case in pre-arbitration, yeah, the chargeback existed, so their chargeback numbers don't go down, but the TC40 is backed out. And so they'll see their fraud numbers go down, so they'll benefit from that. But again, they will see it. And also, the one thing also, by the way, is I notice a lot of folks are focusing with compelling evidence 3.0. They love focusing on subscription recurring, but this also helps any online e-commerce merchant with right. regular customers, you know, yet you're a big online retailer and the person let's use me for an example. You know, one day I'll order paper towels and the next day I'll order AirPods, you know, and then, you know, from a $15 sale to a $200 sale, and then I'll order a laptop and then I'll go back down to ordering oatmeal. But in theory, if you think about it, somebody claims fraud on that. It doesn't say dollar amount. It doesn't say it has to be the same product. It says, wait, the same order came from the same computer, same user, same address, et cetera. That helps them as well, you know, because saying, hey, this is a regular customer kind of going on here. You know, they know who this is. You know, you need to shift this to something else, to another reason code, if it is indeed another reason code. So I think that helps as well.
I would agree. It's cleaning up that ecosystem of chargeback reason code so that we can start to define really what's going on. I think, you know, at the end of the day, the acquirers are really trying to keep their merchants in a position that they can grow their business, keep processing. And to that point, the benefit that the merchant sees is also the benefit that the acquirer sees, right? Like, we need to keep these dispute ratios accurate and concise. So having a situation where compelling evidence is running for their merchants is always going to be strong. I think also they're a strong aggregation point. It's a position where a lot of merchants will have a data source that they can look into to say, hey, again, how big of a deal is this going to be mean for me and for my customers?
You know, it's important, too, to know that with compelling evidence, the thing with compelling evidence, again, I said it earlier, but, you know, it's not necessarily a silver bullet, but it does, you know, I think a lot of folks confuse the term compelling evidence. My wife accuses me of being compelled to speak all the time because I talk too much. But compelling evidence means the other side, in this case, it means the other side must address what is there. But unfortunately, if they do address it, it kind of nulls the argument at that point. Whereas now, again, if we hit the compelling evidence 3.0 marks on a response, if they say, okay, I do, but I still persist that this is unauthorized, they will not rule in the issuer's favor any longer. So that's important to know where our compelling evidence on 3.0 is on the acquiring side is going to, and on the merchant side is really going to mean something for once. So.
You know, if you roll this back a little too and think about the importance of those classifications, they're just not doing classifications to classify. They determine the workflow of this on both sides of the house. You know, if there's an EMV, if they use the classification code for EMV chip not used, right?
Yep.
That's got a workflow and there's an automatic default. But so having these crisply designed is very important in the process.
Yeah, there was one other thing too I wanted to review again that Dom was mentioning is, you know, verticals, right? Like, what industries is this going to be affected by? Think of all of us as consumers. The one thing that we have seen is the QSR space. You know, the QSR space is an area where merchants really have transitioned from a, you know, pay at the service station to pay on your app, order ahead, you know, grocery delivery. Like, that's something we didn't see in the past. These are all great verticals to review and look at what your current transaction volume looks like, where you will have historical transactions that occur more than once in a 120-day window. Because, you know, we see consumers go to this same QSR, they go to the same grocery store once a week, twice a week. These are prime areas for compelling evidence 3.0 to really take a strong effect. And then additional areas like emerging markets, like Brian was talking about, other areas where we really can start to see demographic changes. Well, how about, you know, Latin America is a great, you know, emerging market where we didn't see transactions and chargebacks for such a long time, and another area that is going to be affected greatly, I believe, by this compelling evidence update.
Robert, Dominic, and Brian, I'd like to thank you so much for sharing your insights and perspective. We hope to have you back on soon. Thanks all, and have a great day.